It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. In today's talk, the last in the series on the 12 links of causation, I will try to pass on to you the contents or the main points of the Dalai Lama's fourth talk on the value of altruism. As you recall, the Dalai Lama, according to whose wisdom and scholarship we're definitely relying on in this series, according to him, we have three jobs to do to end the suffering of continuous cycles of birth and death. And the first one is to stop the contaminated actions that are based on afflictive emotions. The second is to stop the afflictive emotions. And the third is to stop the predisposition for afflictive emotions that are ignorance and our afflictive emotions themselves lay down in us. So, and he begins by emphasizing the importance of the last one. So we've heard for a long time, all of us, starting with our mothers, about the need to stop hitting people and yelling and screaming, which are contaminated actions. And I definitely heard from my mother constantly about how selfish I am, which is my afflictive emotion. But the third one, that we need to stop the predispositions for afflictive emotions that being mean and selfish have laid down in us. Most of us, this is new. Most of us haven't heard anything about predispositions, which is the deepest level of this group of three. According to the Dalai Lama, the three trainings of ethics and meditative stabilization and wisdom, those three together are capable of destroying afflictive emotions. And our Soto Zen equivalent would be Zazen and the precepts. So you could say Zazen and the precepts will take care of our afflictive emotions. But to get rid of the latent predispositions established by them, that's really hard. First of all, the reason we even want to do that in the first place is that they prevent simultaneous knowledge of all objects of knowledge. Simultaneous are predispositions for having afflictive emotions prevent simultaneous knowledge of all objects of knowledge, which means basically attaining complete and perfect enlightenment. But that the way he phrases it is so compelling to me. And of course, he has that, you know, you understand. He has that. That's how we can talk about it. Simultaneous knowledge of all objects of knowledge, which means he understands all of our past lives, including his own, all of our thoughts, all of our yearnings, all of our proclivities, simultaneously. So that's what we get with enlightenment, which is the full potential for human consciousness. We are all capable of that. And that would be, and achieving that is achieving the full potential of being a human being. The Dalai Lama says that even those people who have achieved the state of an arhat and have extricated themselves from the cycles of birth and death, even they have not fully developed the potential of being of human consciousness, and therefore they're only halfway. So the question is how? How do we destroy these predisposing tendencies? And the actual weapon is wisdom, the wisdom that understands emptiness, but to overcome the latent tendencies, it's apparently so difficult to really do that. We need merit in addition to wisdom. And the technique for constantly accumulating merit is what the Dalai Lama is calling unusual altruism. So until now, the main concern has been with this one being, you know, ourselves, ourself. In altruistic practice, the concern is with all sentient beings. So it's a very different mindset. And it's consistent with our Soto Zen teaching, which purports the equality of wisdom and merit, and the need for both. So in our case, a lot of times, a lot of Zen students, for example, they're living very meritorious lives. They're doctors and nurses and teachers and social workers, and they're so busy they can't even think about doing Zazen. And the Dalai Lama is addressing just the opposite problem, which is you've got the wisdom side down, but now there's the merit side that needs addressing. And he ends up saying some really interesting things. First of all, he says, sentient beings are limitless. Therefore, when one's consciousness is concerned with an infinite number of sentient beings, the meritorious power that is accumulated by virtuous activities is also limitless. So, for example, going for refuge for the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha out of concern for oneself is very different from going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha out of concern for all sentient beings. They differ greatly in their meritorious power. So the Dalai Lama says, the nature of the altruistic mind is precious. He says, indeed, it is amazing that the human mind can develop such an attitude, for one forgets oneself and considers every other being to be as dear as oneself. This is truly marvelous, he says. Yeah, I think it is. If someone shows us a warm feeling, we feel very happy, and it is the same when we show other people sincere concern. And the Dalai Lama says, I think with that attitude, all of cyclic existence would be like nirvana. It's the real source of happiness, not only in the long run, but even in today. It attracts the best of all experiences and provides the best ground for active participation in society. It serves not only as a teacher, but also as a best friend and protector. It is truly good. So then he tells us that the great Indian panditas set forth two techniques for developing altruism. One through what's called the seven quintessential instructions of cause and effect, and the other through equalizing and switching self and other. Equalizing and switching self and other. I'll briefly talk about the first one, the seven quintessential instructions for cause and effect, preceded by a preliminary practice of developing equanimity with respect to all beings. He just tosses that in, but of course, which one of us can do that, have equanimity with regard to all sentient beings. You know, certain people can really rouse one's anger and ardor and all kinds of things. And we're supposed to have equanimity with regard to all beings. So that's the preliminary practice to these, these seven quintessential instructions, and which are to recognize all beings as friends, to reflect on their kindness, to develop an intention to repay that kindness, to generate love, generate compassion, develop a high resolve of universal responsibility, and engender an altruistic intention to become enlightened. Those are the seven. But in order to generate such a strong altruistic attitude, where one promises to seek Buddhahood for the sake of others, it's beforehand, you have to generate an unusual resolve to take on the burden of others' welfare. And in order to do that, you have to develop an unusual amount of compassion. Where you cannot bear to see others suffering or the oppression by unwanted internal conditions that result in suffering. So this unusual compassion means we cannot bear to see suffering. I mean, really, truly, that we have that. And it's not just, drama, but it's in your heart. You can hardly bear it, along with hardly bearing the suffering that comes from having internal conditions that create suffering, like depression is an example of that. So from the depths of one's heart, one wishes that they be freed from such a condition. And he is saying that unless one is stirred from the depths of one's heart by compassion, the high resolve which one takes on the burden of freeing beings from suffering cannot be induced. So let me just review what I've said so far quickly. There are these three things we need to do to get out of cyclic existence. One is stop our contaminated actions. Two is stop our afflictive emotions that cause the contaminated actions. And three is to stop the predisposition for afflictive emotions that are caused by our afflictive emotions. And in order to do that, we need not only the wisdom that understands emptiness, but we need merit, altruism. And for that, we need compassion. And for compassion, we need equanimity with respect to all beings. So that's basically what I've said so far. And it's clear from our own experience that it's easier to generate compassion for other people who are attractive to us or for whom one feels a sense of pleasure rather than people that we don't find that. They're not appealing to us and we don't find them attractive people. And in order to view beings this way, we first have to see them in an even-minded way for which it's useful to use our imagination. And so here's what the Dalai Lama suggests, that we imagine in front of ourselves a friend and also an enemy and also a neutral person. And then naturally we feel closest to the friend. And we not only feel distant to the enemy, but also often irritated and even angry by them. And then we usually feel nothing for the neutral person. And then he says, well, we have to investigate why. And the first one is our best friend. However, from the Buddhist standpoint, although today he or she is acting like a friend, this is not permanent, because over the course of beginningless rebirths, in some past lifetime, this very person might have been one of our worst enemies. Similarly, although the other one is today acting like an enemy, we cannot be at all sure that in a past life, this person was one of our best friends. And also, there's no guarantee that even when this in this life, things may change. So he says that this is confirmed by our experience of life, and even more so in political life, that today's one's ally is the next moment one's worst enemy. And in this way, the basic life structure is not at all stable. Sometimes we're successful, sometimes unsuccessful. Things are always changing, changing, changing. Therefore, our experience of such solid and stable feelings toward friends and enemies, he says, is absolutely wrong. He says that. It's absolutely wrong. There is no reason to assume such rigidity. It is foolish, is it not? He says. Considering this will gradually help you to become even-minded. The next step is to think that given your enemy was in the past, or will sooner or later, was it, given that your enemy was in the past, or sooner or later will be your friend, it's much better to consider all three, enemy, friend, and neutral, to be your best friend. Just consider everybody your best friend. Also, you can investigate whether there is value. In addition to just consider everybody your best friend, think, is there any value in feeling hatred? What kind of result will come from that? And the answer is obvious. However, if you try to develop compassion toward these people, there's no question that the result will be nice. So from this viewpoint also, you can see that it's much better to develop a compassionate attitude equally to all three, friend, foe, neutral. Compassionate, and think of them as all your best friends. And then he suggests we extend that feeling to our neighbors one by one, those living on this side and that side of the street, then to the whole country, then to the entire continent, then to all of humanity, and then to further infinite sentient beings. And this is how we practice the seven quintessential instructions of cause and effect. So it's a pretty steep ask, I think. But the Dalai Lama is seeing a lot that we don't see. The main thing that he's seeing that we don't see is the speed and certainty of incarnation after incarnation, in which the cast of characters can shift around radically. We're just getting started, even thinking about more than this lifetime. And he takes this entirely for granted. Recall the book I mentioned to you about, by him, about his 13 previous lifetimes. And he's simply telling us, so he takes all of this for granted, and he's simply telling us how it is. And therefore, we shouldn't take our strong negative feelings about people as permanent. The other technique for developing altruism is called equalizing and switching self and other. Here, we should investigate which side is important, me or you, basically, self or other. choose. There is no other choice, only these two. Am I more important or are others more important? Others are greater in number than you, who are just one. Others are infinite. It is clear that neither wants suffering and both want happiness, and that both have every right to achieve happiness and to overcome suffering because both are sentient beings. So if we say, he's so logical. See, he says, if we say, why do I have a right to be happy? The ultimate reason is because I want happiness. There is no further reason. This is what he's saying. We want to be happy because we want to be happy. We have a natural and valid feeling of I on the basis of which I want happiness. This alone is the valid foundation of our right to strive for happiness. It is a human right and right of all sentient beings. Now, if one has such a right to overcome suffering, then other sentient beings naturally have the same right. In addition, all sentient beings are basically endowed with the capacity to overcome suffering. All of us have the capacity to not only overcome suffering of the cycles of birth and death, which the arhats have achieved, but we also have the capacity to attain enlightenment, which is yet another step further. The only difference is that oneself is single, whereas others are in the majority. Here the conclusion is clear. If even a small problem, a small suffering, befalls others, its range is infinite. Whereas when something happens to oneself, it is limited to this single person. When we view that others are sentient beings too in this way, oneself seems not so important. Then he says, let me describe how this is practiced in meditation. This is my own practice, and I frequently speak about it to others. And I'm just blown away by the idea that he's sharing his own practice. This is what the Dalai Lama does. Imagine that in front of you, on one side is your old selfish I, and that on the other side is a group of poor, needy people. And you yourself are in the middle as a neutral third party. Then judge which is more important, whether you should join this selfish, self-centered, stupid person, I, he's saying this, so that's him, the selfish, self-centered, stupid person, the Dalai Lama, or these poor, needy, helpless people. So if you, and he says, if you have a human heart, naturally you will be drawn to the side of the needy beings. This type of reflective contemplation will help in developing an altruistic attitude. You gradually will realize how bad selfish behavior is. You yourself, up to now, have been behaving this way, but now you realize how bad you were. Nobody wants to be a bad person. And if someone says you're a bad person, we feel very angry. Like, why? And the main reason is we don't want to be a bad person. If we really don't want to be a bad person, then the means to avoid it is in our own hands. This is what he's telling us. If we train in the behavior of a good person, we will become good. Nobody else has the right to put a person in the categories of good and bad. No one has that kind of power, but we have the power to train in the behavior of a good person. The ultimate source of peace in the family, the country, and the world is altruism. which he defines as compassion plus love. That's what he says altruism is. Compassion plus love equals altruism. Contemplation of this fact also helps tremendously to develop altruism. When we think about altruism is compassion plus love, just thinking about that helps us to develop altruism. Meditating on these techniques as much as possible engenders conviction, desire, and determination. When with such determination, you try, day by day, month by month, year by year, we can improve ourselves. With altruistic motivation, every action accumulates good virtues, a limitless power of salutary merit. So then there's two very quick questions that his audience asked him. They asked him more, but I wanted to share these two with you because they're so interesting. The first, Your Holiness, you talked about a subtle consciousness continuing as a stream from one lifetime to the next. But after liberation takes place, what happens to the stream of consciousness at the time of death? Does it continue? And the Dalai Lama answers, the subtlest level of consciousness proceeds to and through Buddhahood. It is never extinguished. I just think that's so profound and so powerful. And then the other question, this is for us. Someone asked, yesterday you spoke about the subtlest continuum of consciousness as that which passes from one birth to another and is the inheritor of karma. What do you think of a Buddhist who does not believe in karma or rebirth? That's the question. Answer. Generally, whether or not one is a Buddhist is determined by whether or not one accepts the three jewels, the Buddha, his doctrine, and the spiritual community as pure sources of refuge. So I don't know if you knew this, but what the point at which one becomes a Buddhist is the point where one takes refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. That's it. That's the criteria. When you take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, you are a Buddhist. And until that time, you are not formally a Buddhist. That's the border, that's the boundary point. So then he continues, some Western people cannot accept the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and remain skeptical about karma and rebirth, but nevertheless have high regard for the Buddha, his teaching, and the spiritual community. The latter, it might be said, are persons who are about to become Buddhists. So that's his answer. If you don't believe in karma or rebirth, but you have a high regard for the Buddha and Buddhism in general or whatever, you are a person who is about to become a Buddhist. I just want to point out that that's pretty different from like what Suzuki Roshi says. Suzuki Roshi is extremely clear on the point that number one, we don't have to believe anything. Although I bet you that he would agree that to officially become a Buddhist is the point of taking refuge. That's pretty I think that's pretty established. But Suzuki Roshi says basically, we don't practice Buddhism because Buddha said so, or Buddha said this or that, or Dogen said anything. We don't practice Buddhism because this or that is a belief. We practice Buddhism because of our innate nature, which needs expressing. So we all already have innate nature, Buddha nature, before anybody spoke about anything. Buddha discovered Buddha nature, but we already had it anyway. So we practice Buddhism to express our innate nature, not because Buddha said anything that we should do, or Dogen said anything that we should do, or that we believe this or that. We are just simply expressing our innate nature. And that is what we're doing when we do Zazen. It's a perfect expression of our innate nature, is Zazen. And that's, I guess, why Dogen says that Zazen is enlightenment. It's not to attain enlightenment. So just to wrap up this series, I'd like to tell you again that it was in the spring of 1984 that His Holiness the Dalai Lama spoke about dependent arising in a series of lectures at Camden Hall, London. In 5 sessions over 3 days, he presented the basic worldview of Buddhism, how it views the positions of beings in the world, and how it can make their lives meaningful. An underlying theme of all 5 days was the focus of the last one, which was the fundamental innate mind of wisdom. The Dalai Lama described the obscuration of this basically pure and innermost mind. Obscuration means covered over or hidden, and its manifestation in the wisdom that realizes the emptiness of inherent existence. So I've not shared with you this fifth talk because on the wisdom that realizes emptiness, because it's all about the deepest level of tantric practice, which is a very high level of Tibetan Buddhist practice. So Soto Zen, thankfully, does not require empowerments and many years of preliminary practices to do the most important practices. Tibetan Buddhism is very complicated and long and drawn out, and there are many requirements, and you can't get to point two before doing point one and then a lot of previous points too. So there's a lot. So we have Zazen, which Dogen says is enlightenment. When we are practicing Zazen, we are actually not practicing Zazen. Zazen is practicing Zazen. So all of our self-criticism is simply mental churnings and has little bearing on what is really going on. So what is left, not only to say, but to stress, is the necessity for Zazen, which is the way for Soto Zen students to actualize the enlightened mind. It is the enlightened mind that abolishes ignorance. We cannot ignore this practice, even if it takes place only a few minutes a day. I want to add that Zazen is Zazen and entirely unique in the world of, quote, meditation. Zazen actually isn't meditation. it's not simply another meditation technique. I frequently see people who are thinking about starting a meditation practice and looking at their phones and considering this app or that app and which is most soothing or calming and so forth. Zazen isn't in this lineup. Zazen isn't about getting you some result. Zazen is the result we most want. When you take the Zazen posture, you are accessing emptiness, even if it doesn't feel that way to your thinking mind. The more you settle, the more likely you will begin to feel that way. What we have with Zazen is so much more than a meditation technique. I can't say this to beginners who are scrolling through their phone apps, but I must say this to you, who by now are somewhat seasoned practitioners. Your karma brought you to this precious path. You are so lucky, even though you find it hard. It is hard, but learning to play a musical instrument is hard too. And life is hard. That's why we're trying to get out of it. And we can. That's the message of this series of talks. We can. Thank you. So here are five of the most important points that were made today. First, the nature of an altruistic mind is precious. It is indeed amazing that the human mind can develop such an attitude, for one forgets oneself and considers every other being to be as dear as oneself. This is truly marvelous. The second point. Sentient beings are limitless. Therefore, when one's consciousness is concerned with this infinite number of sentient beings, the meritorious power that is accumulated by virtuous activities is also limitless. Hence, going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha out of concern for oneself, and going for refuge out of concern for a limitless number of sentient beings, differ greatly in their meritorious power. So that's just saying, it's really different to go, I go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha for me, or I go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha for all beings. Those are very different in merit. Third, in order to induce this unusual resolve of altruism, it is necessary to have compassion, in which one cannot bear to see either the manifest suffering of others or their oppression by unwanted internal conditions that result in suffering, like depression. Thus, from the depths of the heart, one wishes that they be freed from such a condition. For unless one is stirred from the depths by compassion, the high resolve which one takes on the burden of freeing beings from suffering cannot be induced. So we've got to have compassion. Fourth, the ultimate source of peace in the family, the country, and the world is altruism, which is compassion plus love. Contemplation of this fact also helps tremendously to develop altruism. Meditating on these techniques as much as possible engenders conviction, desire, and determination. When with such determination we try, we can improve ourselves. With altruistic motivation, every action accumulates good virtues. The limitless power of salutary merit. And finally, the fifth point is the subtlest level of consciousness proceeds to and through Buddhahood. It is never extinguished. And here is an idea for your reflection during the week, and this will be posted. The Dalai Lama says that with altruistic motivation, every action accumulates good virtues, the limitless power of salutary merit. And this is the merit of Soto Zen's formula, wisdom plus merit. So everybody, Tibetan Buddhists and Soto Zen Buddhists, talk about wisdom and merit both being very, very important. He also says, in order to induce this unusual resolve, it is necessary to have compassion, in which one cannot bear to see either the manifest suffering of others or their oppression by unwanted internal conditions. So the upshot is we need compassion, we need altruistic motivation, and finally, altruistic motivation in our every action. So compassion, altruistic motivation in general, and then altruistic motivation constantly. And so here are some questions for you to answer in order to begin this undertaking. And I suggest to take your time and record your answers so you can add to them later, because this isn't going to happen overnight. But while we're starting to actually consciously work on altruism and compassion, here are some things to consider. First, do you consider yourself a compassionate person? And please state your evidence for whatever answer you give. If you think you're a compassionate person, say why. And if you think you're not a compassionate person, say why. The second question, consider that no matter how compassionate you are right now, you don't come near the compassion of the Dalai Lama. Therefore, there is room to improve. So please either make a personal plan to improve your level of compassion, like choose a sentient being a day toward whom to extend your conscious compassion, like that blue jay. That's my being, sentient being for today, and I'm going to extend that blue jay my conscious compassion for the whole day. That's what I'm going to think about. That's one way. Or you can use the Dalai Lama's plan, which is to get in touch with your compassion and extend this feeling to your neighbors, this side of the street and that side of the street, and to the whole country, to the whole continent, to all of humanity in this world, and then to the farthest reaches of sentient beings. So that's the Dalai Lama's plan. My plan was, or what I suggest is, take one sentient being a day. It doesn't have to be a human being. And extend your compassion consciously to that being. It can be your dog. But a different one every day, and see how your compassion develops. And then the third and final suggestion. The other technique for developing altruism is equalizing and switching self and other. Here, one, you should investigate which side is important, self or other. And you have to choose here. And then he shares his own meditation. There's the old I, the old selfish I, the stupid person, and then the needy poor beings, and then the neutral third party. And then you judge which is more important, the old you. Who should you join, the old selfish you or the needy, many needy beings? And if you have a human heart, naturally you'll be drawn to the side of the needy beings. But keep note of your progress. This is hard. We don't become an altruistic person, you know, tomorrow. And so notice small signs of your compassion and altruism steadily growing. Notice this in small ways. You might have a fleeting thought, a fleeting altruistic thought that you might not have ever had before. So I would like to call for questions, but we got a question at the end last week after everyone left. So I'd like to just start with that. And then if there are other questions, please let me know. And this question that came in last week, does karma garnered from the time right after death outweigh other karma? And if so, why? And the answer is yes. In the context of telling us how to help beings who are dying, and telling that we should assist them in developing a calm and relaxed attitude, the Dalai Lama tells us that the reason for that is that the type of attitude that we have near the time of death is extremely important with regard to the karma that is activated, and thus how we will be reborn in the next lifetime. So from this, I gather that at the time of death, I'm just extrapolating from, I just said what the Dalai Lama has told us, that because of the type of attitude that we have near the time of death, it's important with regard to the karma that's activated and how we will be reborn. Because of that, I'm extrapolating that near the time of death, there are potentially a number of different karmas that could ripen into our, and that would be the look of our next lifetime. But which one of those several possibilities actually does develop has to do with our attitude near death. So it doesn't outweigh in the sense of obliterate. We'll still have all of our karma. But in terms of which karma gets activated right now for our very next lifetime, one's attitude at the time of death is really important. And to me, this makes sense. For example, if you're going to visit a friend, or someone that you know, and in the car over, you're reviewing all of their bad qualities, the visit is likely to go very differently from if in the car you're reviewing all their good qualities. So in the case of karma, we know that no karma is ever lost. We will definitely endure our karma. We can lessen it with regret and repentance, for one thing. But what comes up next can be influenced by our minds. And so that's what I'm making of the Dalai Lama statement, depending on our attitude at the time of death, we can activate one karma over another karma. And we should, it's important that we all know this. And if we are assisting someone at their moment of death, it is helpful to help them develop a relaxed and calm attitude for this reason. Thank you. I'm glad the person asked this question. And so now I'll just call for questions in general.
Thank you, Gail. The one that we got right now is, I worry that I will never succeed in attaining enlightenment.
I don't know if you've heard of Shantideva. I guess he's a 12th century poet. He's very beloved in the world of Buddhism. And he says that if there's nothing that can be done to fix a situation, there's no need to worry. And if on the other hand, there's nothing to be done, there's no use in worrying. So by practicing Zazen, you're following what all of the great teachers in the Soto Zen tradition have taught us. Every single one says, they all say the same thing. And so you don't need to worry about the results. If you want to worry about anything, you can worry about your attendance record. We can worry about attending, but this is why we have no gain Zen. A lot of people share this concern, but actually that concern tries to make us attain something with our sitting practice and can actually do harm. So Suzuki Roshi has this statement, when it's hot, we should be hot Buddha. When it's cold, we should be cold Buddha. But he says, this is very direct. Actually, the teaching is, when it's hot, we should kill hot. And when it's cold, we should kill cold. But according to Dogen, when it's cold, we should be cold Buddha. And when it's hot, we should be hot Buddha. And Suzuki Roshi says, if you say kill, kill is extra. And when you say attain enlightenment, attain is extra. We don't need attain. When you do Zazen, there is enlightenment. It's there. There's no attaining anything. Just sit. That's the teaching. We just sit. And there's no gain Zen. We don't sit in order to whatever. We just sit. And in the sitting, we express our innate nature, our Buddha nature. That's all. Thank you.
So the second one, Gail, is like a follow-up. And It is that, is this the same as the idea that in Soto Zen there are no steps?
Yes, it's the same. The reason in Soto Zen there are no steps is that we're not trying to get anything. You know, in most other forms of Buddhism, there's this, you know, answering a koan, getting the right answer. There's attaining enlightenment. But in Soto Zen Buddhism, without depending on teachings, because of our Buddha nature, we practice. And we have an enlightenment experience. But we practice independent of Buddhist teaching and independent of Dogen's teachings. We accept the teachings, but our practice is not based on any teaching. Our practice is based on our original nature. So even if Buddha didn't appear in the world, we all have nature, and we should continue to practice because of our true nature, which Buddha discovered. So it's not a step-by-step thing. It's just sit. It's just sit. And then as we're just sitting, we're expressing our true nature. And that is enlightenment itself. There is no getting anything from there. Attain is extra. So it is all the same. I think I shouldn't take any further questions because we almost have to stop, and I want to make an announcement. So this completes the series on the 12 links of dependent arising, and we'll have 2 weeks of break the rest of October. And then we will have a 6-week series beginning November 5th and ending December 17th, skipping Thanksgiving week or weekend, and ending before the Christmas holiday. So there'll be basically three meetings, the first 3 Sundays in November, then skip Thanksgiving week, and then the first 3 Sundays in December. I think you'll really enjoy this series. It's very different from this one. It's a more heartwarming series. It's called The 4 Embracing Actions. And it's actually a teaching of Buddha's that no one picked up on until Dogen. And so we're gonna have a Dogen teaching that originated with Buddha, but they're very sweet practices. Before we end in December, I will give you a starting date for the series in the new year that will not start until early or middle February, because I am going to take the entire month of January off in order to do an intensive Zen practice at Green Gulch Farm with my teacher, Reb. And so I won't be here at all in January. And I'll have to figure whether I'll have time while I'm on that retreat to create the next series, or whether I'll need time afterwards. So that's what I'll announce at the end of this next 6-week series. So there'll be a 2-week break, and then starting right away November 5th, we'll have a 6-week series that I hope you enjoy as much as I'm already enjoying preparing it. And I want to thank everybody, you for attending, and those of you who attend during the week, and Brian and Sahar and Brendan, who work during the week to make these talks possible. I'm so grateful to all of you. And I look forward to seeing you November 5th. Bye-bye.